This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for downloading this podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. As you know, we build the Scotland Outdoors Podcast out of a live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which featured all sorts of things this week. But we were also trying to pay tribute to one of Scotland's greatest mountaineering characters. Now tell me the truth. Are you curried up warm? Are you underneath the duvet? Are you listening to the radio just thinking to yourself, oh, this is fine and cosy in here? Well, good for you, because it's minus two out here. It's absolutely bitter. But I'll tell you what did happen on the way in here this morning. Twice I had to slow down to let a road here actually trot up the road in front of me before it could find a gateway and heading in. Yeah. Anyway, I'm Mark Stephen, live from BBC Aberdeen Car Park. Joining me this morning in the dark and the cold, Helen Needham.
Good morning. I'm actually quite happy here.
We've got I'm glad to hear it. My work here is done. I can go home now.
There's
then.
A bit of a chill in the air, but it's a good thing. It should be cold at this time of year, don't you think?
Yes. Kills off the bugs, you know.
Exactly. So get in touch if you're out and about already or if you're hiding under the duvet. We always like to hear from you. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk or text 80295. And if you prefer the old-fashioned way of picking up the phone, Lewis is here, 08085 92950.
I wish people could see you this morning.
Why?
Yeah, because of the woolly hat, the socks pulled
up,
and the trousers,
the boots. I know, I've
got
my son's kilt socks on.
You've got son's kilt socks on and what have you. Standing with your hand on a hip, a very Jacobean pose.
Well, I just...
So like Blackadder, you know, moving about, you know.
Yes, I've got a hand-knitted wool hat here from my friend, and all will become clear about why hand-knitted things are so precious.
Yeah, well, I've got a woolen hat, but it's not hand-knitted. So I have a badge of shame, basically. Coming up, I've been along to Forview Nature Reserve this week, and we hear about the couple starting a new life on rum. And Ewan might not be here this week, but the mystery bird eats.
And he kindly left us a sound to identify. See if you can guess what it is. We're not going to give you any clues.
Nope.
Absolutely none at this stage, but if you have an idea, I'm sure many of you will. It's a dear sweet sound, that, isn't it?
It is.
You can get in touch, email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295 or call Lewis on 08 085 92950.
As I was saying earlier, this week I headed just along the road from me to Forview Nature Reserve. Now, just because it's coming into winter, the work doesn't stop. Just because there's a pandemic on, the work doesn't stop. Although, obviously, there's a limit to what volunteers can actually do. I joined up with Reserve Manager Daryl Short. Not with a volunteer. He'd roped in help from a little closer to home.
So today's job is a bit of footpath repair work at Hackley Bay, one of the most beautiful spots on Forview National Nature Reserve. And in the summer, after the lockdown restrictions were eased, our visitor numbers went through the roof, and all that extra footfall obviously has an impact on the infrastructure, and it's up to us as reserve staff to try and repair any damage and keep on top of things. So that's today's job, a bit of footpath work.
I would imagine even with current restrictions, you know, there are limits to what you can do with volunteers and things, but you've kind of brought your own.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we can have volunteers in for certain jobs. We have to be very careful with social distancing. In this case, we've borrowed Catriona Reid, who's normally the reserve manager at Muir of Dinnet. But Catriona, being my wife, can work in my pocket without too much bother at all. We're essentially the same person. So yeah. That's what's happening today.
Lucky. I mean, basically, it's something of a busman's holiday.
Yeah, but I mean, what a place for a busman's holiday. You know, Hackley Bay is fantastic, isn't it? It is just a gorgeous coastline we're on here. And, oh, there's worse place to spend a day away from your office, isn't there?
See, I think this is one of the most beautiful places in Scotland, never mind Forfar Reserve. But it always kind of reminds me of Cornwall. You know, it's unusual to have this sort of 200-metre chunk taken out of the coastline with a beach behind it.
It is here, I suppose, yeah. Most of our coastlines are either sandy or shingly or cliff. But here you've got this big sand beach that runs all the way from Aberdeen to the appropriately named Rock End. Then you've got this chunk of rocky coast. And then you've got this beautiful sort of crescent half moon of Hackley Bay. And then you've got the cliffs all the way up to, well, pretty much Peterhead after that, actually. So Cruden Bay, I suppose. It's got the bonny beach there as well. But yeah, it is a lovely place. And it can come as a surprise if you don't know it's here when you walk the cliff path.
Ah, great. And what Daniel was saying about footfall here, same at Muir of Dinnet?
Yes, definitely. Our visitor numbers went through the roof sort of late June, early July when the lockdown was lifted. And for the most part, it was people just piling out to enjoy themselves because they'd been kept indoors for so long. It was great to see how much people need nature and how much they want to get into the countryside, but it did bring a few issues because obviously not everybody behaved themselves, and I think that was quite true across the whole of the country.
What kind of problems were you having?
Dirty camping for the most part. Too many cars often initially was when people coming in and the car parks would fill and overflow and then
I think I saw that on Twitter by 8:30 in the morning. We are full, go away.
Yeah, you're probably right. I say nobody was going abroad and everybody was piling into the countryside, so there were parking issues, but an awful lot of issues with dirty camping, the sort of camping you really don't want to see, where people light fires in inappropriate places, leave a lot of litter, leave human waste, which is really unpleasant for absolutely everybody, and in some cases dump the tents behind them as well. Yeah. So we had a lot more of that than I'd like to have seen.
It must be, I don't know, maybe 80, 90 feet down to the beach here, Daniel, you know, and there's a long winding path. We're just at the very head of the path. Where did these rocks come from?
Right, so yeah, it's probably common knowledge that it's not really good practice to lift stone off the beach to do any building work or anything. It's you know, it's illegal as far as I'm aware. This is a bit of an exception because the stone we're using here is the leftovers from when the main staircase was built 20-odd years ago or whenever it was. And what I think happened was when the job was complete, the contractors basically tipped the remaining stone over the cliff down at the beach. So if you have a rummage on the beach here, there is a selection of this lovely, I think it's pink Peterhead granite,
yeah, it is.
In amongst all the native stone. So rather than taking the native beach stone, we're using this leftover granite. And the nice thing is it actually matches the rest of the staircase. But yeah, it's quite a hike. It's about 190 steps from the beach up to where we're standing currently. And with a big slab of granite in your arms, it feels a lot further than that.
Yeah. I must confess, I was wandering out here because, you know, I'd heard, well, I knew that Daryl was going to be here. I didn't know you were going to be here, Kat. But I was thinking, how do you get all the tools and things here?
Shanks pony.
You just hump it.
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, there are bits in most of the reserves you can get vehicles to, but there are other bits in most of the reserves you can't get vehicles to. And yeah, just hump it's a pretty good summary of how the stuff gets here.
Yeah. And how big, you know, because I think an awful lot of folk think that being a ranger is a wonderful job. It's a bit like being in Walt Disney all the time. Well, it is a wonderful job, yeah, but it's not all listening to birdies going tweet, tweet. There's a lot of really quite hard physical labour involved.
Oh, yeah, I mean, there is often, yeah, you're perhaps right, there is a perception it's all rare birds and roses, but there is a lot of good labour involved too. You know, as you say, when you're hauling rocks, like Daryl's done up 190 steps, it keeps you fit. I've often thought there's two ways you can keep fit. You can either, you know, go to a gym and really discipline yourself to walk 10,000 steps every day, or you can just work your arse off in the fresh air every single day.
Which, in the current regime, is probably the best way of doing it. Probably,
definitely.
What's the next job on the list?
Well, once this is finished, there's a selection of similarly glamorous jobs. This is the time of year for what we technically term hard yakka. So
hard yakka?
Yeah, a bit of Australian phrase there, yakka. Hard work, hard labour. So stuff like ditch clearing, road mending, looking after the footpaths, all the sort of heavy stuff that we don't really have time to do over the summer. just put the boot in. Get it nice and level. Happy days.
Is this what you describe as fair division of labour? You get to humph all the rocks about and place them and do the digging and things like that, and he jumps up and down and says, yes, I'm pleased with that.
Well, I say every job needs a skilled foreman.
Thankfully, every job needs a lackey as well.
Daryl's braver than me. Daryl Shorts and his co-worker and wife, Catriona Reid, at Hackley Bay on the 4V Nature Reserve near Aberdeen. Lovely folk.
Yeah, I'm kind of jealous in a way because I do enjoy working outside in a bit of hard labour, and but I spend a lot of time.
Oh, come round to mine, I can give you a list. It's not a problem.
It's all to do with time.
Time. A few weeks back, in our Embracing Winter special, we were advised by the wonderful Siri Macklin from Norway to wear wool, 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 she said.
And this sparked off a bit of debate about Scottish wool. Someone got in touch to say they couldn't get hold of 100% Scottish wool, so they ended up getting theirs from Norway. So we thought we'd investigate further.
Yeah, we thought, well, that can't be right. We found a lovely lady called Louise Scully. This is a very keen knitter and an advocate of all things woolly and Scottish. And basically, she told us about the growing network of Scottish yarn producers.
Louise has got a podcast called Woolwork, which is listened to all over the world. So we invited her to be a guest on our podcast, Scotland Outdoors. And of course, she was fully decked out in wool.
The cardigan that I'm wearing now, which of course nobody can see, but it's a Cheviot. I always like saying that because I don't think a lot of people know that Cheviot make nice wool for knitting with, but it's incredible. It's hardy. It could probably stand up on its own and it will probably outlive many winters. So, yeah, it's like a hug.
You mentioned the sheep. Let's look at Shetland sheep. Why are they so prized for their wool?
They're really, really spectacular. They're one of our primitive breeds, very similar to the Neolithic animals. They're part of the Northern European short-tailed breed, which also includes Hebridean, Soe, Borrowe, North Ronaldsey, these great Scottish breeds. And they are wee sheep that have absolutely evolved to live on the rockiest outcrops and the peripheries of Scotland, certainly. So that's number one for me. They're just absolutely fantastically hardy. But when it comes to their fleece, they offer this veritable smorgasbord of colours. There are somewhere between 9 and 11 natural colours in Shetland sheep, which is an absolutely phenomenal thing. You don't find that in any other breed. And then there are different textures within one fleece. Traditionally, the neck wool of a sheep is seen as the softest and finest, and that is what is used in creating these fantastic heirloom wedding ring shawls that you may see, as well as making the finest, most delicate things, it can make the most hardiest and well-wearing things like fair isle.
What about the environment the sheep are raised in? I was out walking a dog and there was kind of a real mixed bag of sheep next to me. There was a couple of Texels, a couple of mules, a couple of blackface, all out there and out. You know, it was driving rain this morning. How much does the environment impact on the quality of the wool?
The wool is grown to, in many cases, deflect dirt, sand, rain, so that the softer wool fibres on the sheep's back and closer to the sheep's skin are kind of protected. But in terms of what impact the weather has and the environment has on fleece, it's the same as growing any other crop. If you get a good growing season, you get a good fleece. If you get a really, really quite wet and dreary growing season where the sheep's back is absolutely sodden, you get breaks in the fleece and you get weaker fleece. And that, I believe, then leads to a lower price when that is graded and sorted. When you start to look into provenance and you realise how much is out there in terms of how much wool there is in the UK, I mean, there's anywhere between 60 and 90 breeds if you, depending on where you get information and if you include crosses and things, that is more than any country. And when you look at the size of our isles, it's an absolutely amazing thing to have that diversity of breeds and of the textures and characteristics of those fleece and what they become like in yarn. Your correspondent, the last episode, who talked about buying wool in Norway, you know, that Norway is a big wool destination as well. Iceland, Scandinavia. You know, it's incredible that people want to go places and as part of their holiday want to take a bit of that wool away with them as well.
Something like merino wool from New Zealand has become very fashionable in recent years, particularly amongst folk like us, you know, outdoor enthusiasts. fine, it's from New Zealand. I mean, does Scottish wool have the same potential?
Merino wool is incredible, and it is amongst the finest fibre out there. Fibre is measured in microns, and the lower the micron, the finer the wool. Merino has the finest diameter, and it's very hard to find Scottish wool that parallels that. In British wool, we have Blueface Leicester, which is one of the English long wools, which it can get as fine as merino. But there is a really, really good luck story in this, which is the Beaumont sheep, which I don't know if you've heard of before, but the Beaumont sheep were actually designed by the Macaulay Institute. They wanted to try and find a sheep that could provide wool as soft as merino, but could live in the UK, because merinos are not best suited to our climate. So the Beaumont is a mixture of merino and Shetland, and it creates this wool which goes into Finisterre, who create a lot of wool base layers and wool products.
We were talking earlier about the fact that, you know, every handmade garment has something of the creator invested in it. Of all the thousands of items that you've probably made in your life, what was the one item that you had most of you invested in? What was it?
Oh, that's really hard, actually. I mean, I think making a Shetland hat was an incredible thing for me, because the Shetland hat has many guises. A hat can essentially be any kind of square or triangular shawl, from the most heirloom wedding ring shawls
that can pass through a wedding ring, yeah.
Yeah, to the humble hat, which I call the humble hat, which was essentially a triangle or a square with a very plain centre and a little bit of feather and fan stitch, or old shale it's called, just a very simple lace edging. And that was the one that I wanted to learn to knit, because that was the one that Shetland women made for themselves. So they had to keep the good wool for the fine haps, and they had to use what was left to make the items for them, to keep them warm. And they did whatever they could do to make them look a bit pretty. So they might dye them themselves, or they might try and add in different colours. And when I think how important the hap has become for knitters, it's one of those things that knitters like to make. They like to tick off their knit list, and you know, there have been some books written about Shetland haps in the last few years. And when I think of how that's come up from this humble thing to being something that every knitter in the world wants to make, I felt extremely proud to make a humble Shetland hat. And it's something that I do trot. I should have brought it out. It's massive, but it's something that I trot out every winter.
Isn't that an absolute delight to find somebody that's that passionate about a subject?
Yes, completely.
You know, they can just talk with enthusiasm for hours and hours and hours on the subject.
And infectious as well, because I found myself wearing nothing but wool since we spoke to her.
I thought you were walking funny. Louise Scholey, and you can hear more about Scottish wool at the Scotland Outdoors podcast. Just head to BBC Sounds and you'll find her.
Stark Talk pays tribute to mountaineering pioneer, the late Hamish McInnes.
My memory hurtled back nearly 30 years to when I met him.
Why is it that you are so attracted to hostile country?
The hostile country is usually the last place to be explored.
And so this extra podcast is from the recording that day and in his memory.
You know, sometimes you don't go to the top at all. Rock climbing, for example, you often spend all day in a little crag or something.
Join Edie for an archive conversation with Hamish.
Does it make you feel differently about death, do you think, from other people?
You certainly get very used to it.
Listen by searching for Stark Talk on BBC Sounds.
Yeah, we were all saddened to hear of the death of Hamish McInnes this week, and coming up shortly we're going to play a longer excerpt of that interview Edie did with Hamish 30-odd years ago, as well as talking to a few of his admirers and friends.
So, what about the mystery bird? There's a few answers in already, which I'll come to after we hear the sound again.
Well, here's some of the answers we've got so far. Ian Ross in Blackburn thinks it might be a pied wagtail. Good guess, Ian, but no. And Leslie in Edinburgh said, is the bird a dipper?
Lots of people saying, could it be a dipper? Donald in Oban, Coxie in Dunkeld, Sandy Faye Dunglass, Barry Sutherland saying Water Dipper or Yellow Whitetail.
Ooh.
Michael Evans.
Yellow Whitetail.
What's that?
I don't know if there's a yellow wagtail. I don't know if there's a yellow whitetail.
Don't know.
I think that's maybe a misprint.
Right. Michael Evans from Dundee is Dipper. Love the programme and very informative and interesting, says David in Carlisle. He's guessing Dipper. And Gary in Pennycook says, could it be a rock pipit?
That's a very good guess too. Yeah. Dipper's a fascinating bird because it's got that sort of nictitating membrane over its eye, so it dives under the water and it's almost like built-in swimming goggles.
Mm. Well, anyway, if you've got a guess, no point getting in touch to ask if it's a dipper because it's not, but we have had two right answers already. Get in touch. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295 or call Lewis on 08085 92 95 00.
You may or may not remember the Warity report into grouse boar management that was published at the end of last year. Now, the report made 58 recommendations, but the most controversial was probably the suggestion of licensing for shooting estates. Now, the report proposed a 5-year probationary period before that was done. However, earlier this week, the Scottish Government announced that licensing would be brought forward much sooner than the 5 years. BBC Scotland's environment correspondent Kevin Keane explains here how licensing will work.
And what it will do when it becomes law is it will effectively tip the balance for investigating these crimes. So at the moment, it's essentially a criminal matter. The police have to prove in a court beyond reasonable doubt whether or not a bird of prey has been killed illegally on an estate before any prosecution can succeed. With licensing, you would like give a license to a shooting estate. If there were found to be lots of cases of golden eagles or other birds of prey disappearing on the land, that will then start to lead to questions, and the burden would then be on the landowner to prove that nothing untoward is going on before a licence is issued again. And that's seen really as a key moment in trying to tackle this issue, which I have to say landowners say is not such an issue anymore, than that they believe they have got to the bottom of it. But we heard the minister today say that it continues to be a significant and ongoing issue, and of course an issue that is very divisive between those like RSPB Scotland, who say that this is an extremely proportionate response, and then a lot of rural organisations who say the exact opposite, that it's a disproportionate response and that it's going to cripple the rural sector.
Our environment correspondent Kevin Keane there. And obviously Manu Goujon made the announcement, and this is still a process in train, but it, as Kevin rightly points out, it is hugely divisive.
You know, yeah.
People are, you know, there's a very clear line down the middle between this.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of that is to do with tradition and everything caught up with the notion of sporting estates. But we'd actually really love to hear from you about this, because I know listening to Drive Time with John Beattie the other day, I think it was Thursday, there was just so much response from people listening to this one. It's a very emotive subject. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, or you could give Lewis a call on 08085 92 95 00. And we do want to look at this in more detail. Yeah. We want to give it a bit of time and thought.
Yeah, and actually go and talk to a few people out in the countryside and, you know, basically get all the perspectives we possibly can. We will be doing that over the next few weeks. Now, a few months ago, you may recall, I built myself a fairly Heath Robinson moth trap. It was Heath Robinson, but it did work. I was keen to know what species of moth I had in there, and handily enough, just a few miles away from where I live, lives Dr. Mark Young, Emeritus Senior Lecturer in the School of Biological Sciences at Aberdeen University. Mark's a lovely guy, and he's able to put me right with my Hebrew character and Quaker moths and everything else. Well, I'm delighted to say that this week, Mark received a very special award, the RSPB 2020 Nature of Scotland Lifetime Achievement Award, for his contribution to nature conservation. First and foremost, many, many congratulations on the award last night. That was fantastic.
Well, thank you very much indeed. It makes me feel rather old to have a Lifetime Achievement Award, but hey, there we are. Never mind.
The award cited many things. Obviously, your academic work, the way you've assisted so many people into, you know, works in ecology and entomology and, you know, lepidopterists and people who have really developed a passion for the science, largely thanks to your efforts. But make the case for me. People get very excited about big animals, megafauna. What role do insects actually play in the wider world?
Well, they have a fantastically important role to play in so many different things. Everybody will have heard, I'm sure, about pollination and the fact that insects play such a big part of that. They're so much involved in decomposition in various different ways, including in the soil. But, of course, the people who work on fungi and bacteria would also talk about that. They are predators of garden pests and crop pests, but they are also prey themselves for birds and so on. Insects are by far the most abundant of the multicellular animals that are around, and they have a role in absolutely everything. If we did without them, well, we couldn't do without them. If they become really scarce, then everything would go to pieces.
Has anybody ever done a calculation just in terms of simple biomass?
Oh, yes, and insects make up an enormous part of the biomass. I can't instantly remember numbers, but I can tell you this, if it's interesting. In tropical forests, ants alone, let alone all the other insects, outweigh all of the vertebrates put together.
That's just extraordinary. Just the ants themselves?
Just the ants themselves. Ants aren't as common in northeast Scotland, but in tropical rainforests they make up that huge proportion of what's there.
Your particular speciality is micromoths. You know, the last time I was here you were taking them out of the trap and things like that, and you can identify lots of them. You chair several recorder groups. What are the recorder groups actually responsible for? What do they do?
Well, unless we know what lives where and in what sort of abundance or which ones are rare, then, of course, we have very little handle on what's happening in the environment. And so what I try and do by talking to lots of other people is to get a much better handle on where micromoths occur, and not just micromoths, but all butterflies and moths, whether they're endangered, what sort of abundance they're in, and that gives us an idea of things like changing climate, changing environment, you know, whether agricultural changes are having an impact, and so many other things. So that's what we're trying to do. And there are national schemes for recording the distribution and abundance of all these different things.
People get passionate about all sorts of things, you know, militaria or train numbers, you name it. Something like them, and I can see that the passion you have for this just shines through, you know, and I see that and I respect it. But let me ask you a brutal question. What difference does it make whether a particular micromoth's in an area or not?
If you take an individual micromoth, I don't know what the answer to that would be. It depends which species you're talking about. But so many of them have a really important role or are indicators of really important things. Let's take the tiny little moth, the diamondback moth. It comes to us from the continent, from south in the continent. It's a regular migrant year by year. Its abundance, its distribution, where it is telling us about the way in which insects are moving north in response to climate change. It's telling us about the migration and mobility of insects, many of which are pests. It's telling us an awful lot about many of the things we need to know if we're going to interpret what's going on in the world.
These people who share your passion, is the community growing? You know, across your professional career, are there now more people out there interested than there were?
There are far more people interested in butterflies and moths generally. There really are. The number of people in the general population who are interested in environmental matters has grown hugely, and the interest in butterflies and moths has also grown. On the other hand, there are certainly not more people interested in micromoths. That's a rather specialist thing. And we're all of us a little worried that, as I am, the what you might call experts are all rather old. So we're doing our very best to try and encourage younger people to get involved, particularly trying to convert those people who have come into butterflies and then into moths, the larger moths, to get them to transfer their interest down into the smaller ones as well, which are more interesting in some ways. They're less well known, there's more you can find out, and there's more we need to know.
We started off this conversation by you saying, you know, it's a bit alarming getting a Lifetime Achievement Award as if someone's decided to pull the plug. But you have a legacy. There's no doubt of the fact you have a legacy. Which part of it do you think you will be proudest of?
Isn't that tricky? I'm proud of some of the work I've done with rare butterflies and moths or with freshwater pearl mussels or whatever. Of course I am. But I am equally proud to have so many students and fellow enthusiasts who are out there doing good things. And I've had some role in teaching them about ecology and teaching them about butterflies and moths and encouraging them to do what they're doing now. That's really important to me as well.
Dr. Mark Young, recipient of this year's RSPB Nature of Scotland Lifetime Achievement Award. I mean, richly deserved. And I've said this before, one of the things I really dislike about the COVID-19 crisis is the fact you cannot shake somebody's hand. Mm. You know, and I really wanted to there because, you know, just to say congratulations properly.
The sentiment was there.
Yeah.
Right, more people getting in touch about the mystery bird. Look, I've told you, it's not a dipper, Derek, Fred, Michael.
Nobody listens.
Willie
Nobody
the farmer near Brecon, who seems to get in touch every week.
Yeah, pretty well.
Mystery bird's a tree creeper. No.
Nope.
John and Lewis in Rothy Norman. Good morning, Mark and Helen. Is the mystery bird a dipper? No. Good morning. Keep warm. A touch bracing. Who needs to go swimming outdoors in winter when you can live in Rothy Norman?
You go swimming in winter.
I do. And another one here. Chaffinch says, Lynn and Fife, stay cosy up there in Aberdeen. And Ian in Kintore says, is the mystery bird a wren?
No.
No.
No, although I have had a lot of wrens recently. Coming up, we pay our own tribute to mountaineer Hamish McInnes, who died earlier this week. We look at life on the island of Rum, and here's another chance to hear this week's mystery bird.
People are starting to get this right. We're slightly distracted by a very strange sound in the background.
It's like barking, and I cannot figure out whether it's a fox, potentially, or a dog.
Hmm.
Or possibly, I mean, would it be a deer around a bit here?
Don't know. No idea. Very strange. Anyway, back to the bird. I just wanted to read this one out. It is a correct answer from Liz Swan in Argyll. I'm not going to reveal what
well
the
done,
answer
Liz.
Is, obviously.
Well obs. Obs,
she
as
says,
the young people say.
I am in my warm kitchen baking this morning. Marmalade cake and bread. Ooh, marmalade cake.
Marmalade.
Oh, yeah. Love to listen to your programme every Saturday whilst I bake.
That's a nice thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. Another one here from Alison in Edinburgh. She says, it's too cold to get up. I'm enjoying my good woolen blanket. The bit that the dogs haven't claimed anyway. Is the mystery bird a goldcrest? They've got a wee thin voice like that. Dead sneaky of yous it is, distracting us with running water. Well, there's a wee clue about the running water, isn't it?
That is a wee clue.
Get in touch if you've got an idea. It's text 80295. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. And you can call as well on 08085 92 95 00.
And how nice of you to imagine that we're that intelligent to indulge in that kind of sophistry.
What, yeah. About the water?
Yeah, about the water.
Yeah.
No.
Or maybe Ewan's taken it to a new level.
It could be. Could be. I'm definitely hearing something across there. I don't know what it is. I'll tell you something else you can see. See that just in amongst the trees?
Yeah.
That's Venus.
It's absolutely gorgeous. Yeah. The sun is slowly coming up and the sky is just turning blue, isn't it? I actually find it a real privilege to be outside at this time of the morning.
Yeah.
I try to do it regularly.
Yeah, no, but most mornings I am, I must confess. I need to find out what that noise is. That's annoying me now. Hamish McInnes died earlier this week at the age of 90. Really, the archetypal man of the mountains. His achievements were unbelievably varied, many of which we'll hear later. But first, we're going to hear an excerpt from an interview Edie Stark did with Hamish back in 1992 for a BBC Radio Scotland series called The Achievers.
Well, I certainly felt in the past that I'd like to have lived in the middle of the last century, when there's lots of opportunity for exploring and you didn't have to do any pseudo-exploring. And really, one of the reasons that so many people are interested in mountaineering is that, and also doing new routes, that's a form of exploration. You're doing something new and something different. It's the sense of adventure and exploration which appeals to people.
It's also a sense of being first.
That's true. Yes, I think that's true, and it's a very difficult thing to explain why this should appeal, but it certainly does appeal.
Is it supreme arrogance?
Could be. It could be, and I think, you know, explorers are very often arrogant. I know lots of people who have gone into explore areas and written up reports about them. Well, the native people have been going to these areas for years,
quite,
and they didn't have the ability to write it up. But certainly some of the areas we were in Amazonia, there's no one been in before.
When you do discover a new area, when you are almost convinced that nobody has been there before, how do you feel inside? Is it elation?
Yes, to a certain extent it is, but it's, it goes on for quite a long time. And it's there's always a question mark in these places because they're very inaccessible. And there's always the problem that you get into this area, you're going to get back out again. And that's certainly very true in Amazonia, where we're heading down into the Amazon Basin. And it comes to a point where you can't go back. You've got to press on, hoping you're going to get out at the other end. And it can be slightly scary, this.
Do you often experience that sensation of raw fear?
No, I don't. Quite fortunate, I suppose. I don't. I'm not very often frightened. But certainly in a situation like that, it's lurking in the back of your mind all the time. Are we going to make it? And this is part of the attraction, I should think.
You've played a very active part in mountain rescue. It's put you in touch with death directly on many an occasion. Does it make you feel differently about death, do you think, from other people?
You certainly get very used to it. You get used to, handling bodies and getting bodies out of difficult places, avalanches or strung up in cliff faces and that. You certainly get very used to it. You don't get blasé about it, but...
I wonder, though, do you get inured to it in some way?
Well, you get inured to it, there's absolutely no doubt about it. I mean, that never worries me at all.
You don't get over-emotional?
No, I don't get over-emotional at all.
Yeah. How do you stop yourself becoming over-emotional?
It's certainly very unpleasant to arrive at the scene of an accident and discover it's a friend of yours that's dead. What's even worse is trying to resuscitate a friend who's perhaps in an avalanche and he or she dies in you.
But most people would find more dramatic adjectives than very unpleasant.
Yes,
I would say heartbreaking, tragic.
Yes, I suppose that I think one gets so used to it that...
Even with friends?
Well, I've lost a lot of friends over the years. I mean, it certainly affects you. You certainly feel it so much closer to you than someone you don't know.
But it doesn't make you weep?
No, it doesn't, no. But, it certainly makes one very conscious of traps that are there for the unwary.
Do you look in the mirror and think, I am an adventurer?
No, not at all.
I am John Wayne.
No, not at all, no. I can think of lots of people who were, years gone by, but it's difficult being a true adventurer nowadays, I think. After saying that, I think of four or five places in the world which I really like to go if I just get the time. I feel there's some very interesting questions to be answered. As Bernard Shaw said, you've got to live from one objective to the other, something like that. And I think this is very true. Yes, as soon as you lose your objectives, I think you lose your passion for life.
Hamish McInnes there, talking to Edie Stark 30 years ago for a series Edie made for BBC Radio Scotland called The Achievers. And you can hear the whole of Edie's conversation with Hamish on the Stark Talk podcast series, which you can find on BBC Sounds. Joining us now to tell us about the influence and the legacy of Hamish McInnes is Stuart Uni, Chief Executive Officer with Mountaineering Scotland. Good morning, Stuart. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, thanks, Mark. How are you?
Not bad at all, thank you. Not bad at all. He left behind a huge legacy in mountaineering circles. Just talk us through it.
Yeah, I mean, goodness, where do you start talking about Hamish McInnes? I suppose, first and foremost, he was a climber and a mountaineer of great talent, and his achievements are well documented. He started climbing at a really early age, I think about 16, and he went on to hone his skills with the famous Craig Dew Club at the time, many of whom came from the working class roots in Glasgow and from the shipyards and the docks. And they really were the hard men of Scottish climbing at the forefront of pushing standards at the time. And as a result, he became a very highly accomplished climber and mountaineer. involved in lots of hard first ascents in the Scottish mountains, and as well as expeditions to the Himalayas and all over the world. And you know, I think what's really important about him, though, is that his legacy touches everyone who enjoys being in the hills and the mountains, whether you walk or whether you climb. And his work on TV and film and his many books have helped to bring climbing and mountaineering, and I love the Scottish mountains particularly, to a much wider mainstream audience.
But he's also played a significant role in terms of mountain rescue.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he was hugely influential, and as you said, I think, earlier in the programme, he's often referred to as the founding father of modern mountain rescue. He not only founded the Glencoe Mountain Rescue Team, he helped to found the Search and Rescue Dog Association, SARDA, also the Scottish Avalanche Information Service, which we all depend on as part of our planning when we're going into the hills in the winter. And he also pioneered new mountain rescue techniques and specialised training for mountain rescue teams. And really, it was an influence that spread not just through Scottish mountain rescue teams, but rescue teams all over the world.
Yeah. He was quite, as I understand it, quite good with his hands, you know, and he designed the very first all-metal ice axe, which I only found out recently was actually made by Massey of Massey Ferguson, the tractor company. I mean, it was, again, just explain, I mean, I'm not a climber. Explain to me why that was so significant.
Yeah, well, you know, he was a man of many talents, and that's part of, you know, his legacy, again, is his design and engineering skills, which he used to create that first all-metal ice axe, which was actually put into commercial production after, I think, he attended an incident where, unfortunately, a couple of climbers had died, and he noticed that the wooden shaft, the traditional ice axe at that time, was a wooden shaft with a metal pick. And he decided then to make his designs available to the public. But he went further than that, and he introduced, as part of that axe, a new, much more steeply angled pick, which then totally changed ice climbing techniques and then allowed standards to be pushed beyond what had been possible before. But, you know, he didn't just design the ice axe as well. The McInnes stretcher, which is another one of his iconic inventions, a foldable stretcher which was more easily carried into the hills, and you know, he continued to adapt and evolve the design of that throughout his life, and you know, when it was first introduced, it was a huge boon to mountain rescuers all over the world, and it's still used today by emergency and rescue services all over the world.
He also wrote a lot as well, and there's a particularly significant book, The International Rescue Handbook.
Yeah, that's right, and it's another hugely important part of his contribution to the culture and the history of Scottish mountaineering. And that first book really became the template for modern mountain rescue right across the world. But he wrote many other books. He wrote many climbing and walking guide books to Scotland. He also works of fiction, murder mystery stories. But he's probably best known, I think, for his compilations of mountain rescue stories and other mountain adventures, which really helped to establish him as one of the first Scottish mountaineers to really become a household name.
Quite an interesting thing in that clip we heard from the Edie Stark interview 30 years ago, where he said he'd wish he'd been born in the previous century. You know, he had that kind of sort of slightly buccaneering approach to life.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, I think He was one of the defining characters of modern mountaineering. As you heard, quite a hard man, quite a tough character, capable of real feats of endurance. But, you know, he was ultimately someone who made saving the lives of others his life's work. But, you know, he was also a real, as you heard in the clip, he was a thinker. You know, he certainly wasn't an establishment figure. He didn't accept the status quo, but he looked at things, he looked at what could be done differently and what could be done better, and he had ultimately the ingenuity and skills to make it happen. And he really wasn't just a man of his own time. I mean, I think he'll continue to be a hugely important part of mountaineering history and a genuine legend.
Stuart, thank you very much for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll hear later in the programme from Heavy Hawley, who knew Hamish well. Coming up soon, we're going to be chatting live to a couple who have left Bristol to take up a new life on the island of Rum. Rummage, you know, is one of the small isles in the Inner Hebrides, along with Egg, Muck and Canna.
Yep, and a few years ago, actually, I spent some time on Rum. Fascinating place. 2012 this was. It's bizarre, isn't it? We're running these archive pieces since the whole corona thing, and going back, you just, your memories.
Did I do that? Really?
Was that me? Was Did I go there? But I do remember going to Rum, and as well as looking for red deer, I also went on search for Manx shearwaters. Here I am in the company of Leslie Watt from Scottish Natural Heritage as we neared the colony. Night is falling. We're just picking our way through the rocks and the grass around the top of Halliwell here. And it feels like on a rite of passage or something here, coming high up here in the mist to try and find these birds. The wind's getting up, the air's damp. Something quite thrilling about it, really.
There's a bird in this burrow. It's actually calling out from the burrow, so if everyone, if you just pay close attention when you're walking past, we won't linger too long because we don't want to disturb the birds, but they're actually calling out at the moment from their burrows, and that may be them calling to the ones that are still out at sea foraging and helping them to find their mate when they return. So if yeah, there's a few burrows at the moment that seem to be occupied, so you can have a little listen. Yeah, which I wasn't expecting this early because it is still early in the season for the birds to be returning, so I wasn't expecting it to be very busy in the colony at the moment, so it's a very good indication that the population here is still doing well and is healthy.
Leslie, your face just lit up when we stopped there. It was amazing. Excitement.
Yeah, I've been doing this for almost 5 years now, and I still get very, very excited every time when the birds come back, and especially when we're checking productivity and it's a good year and we find lots of burrows with chicks, and I think I get more excited than the people that I'm showing them.
It's good. The passion is great. Leslie, this is a very surreal experience because we've been kind of hiding behind rocks for probably about an hour. It's maybe 10 o'clock at night and it's windy and misty, but we're starting to hear things.
Yeah, we're just waiting until it gets really, really dark because the birds won't start coming in until it's complete darkness. So at the moment, because there's quite a big moon, it's taking a little bit longer than normal to get dark. So as you can see, as we've been sitting here, it's gradually been getting darker and darker. And now the activity's starting. You can hear birds calling from their burrows for their mates that are coming back in from sea. And you can hear the calls getting louder as they're emerging from their burrows and calling from the surface. And hopefully not too long from now, we're going to start hearing birds calling as they're flying in from the sea.
And apparently they're quite clumsy, so we should be aware of the fact that they might not be able to find their burrows that easily.
Yeah, they're very capable of finding the burrows, but they're very clumsy at landing when they come in, so they're not so good on land. And as you could see when we came up in the light, that it's a very rocky landscape here, so there is a high probability that they can crash into these rocks, and that's why we're all sitting quite low to the ground, because if we are standing up, then there's a high probability that they will hit us as well.
Above us and below us, what's happening right now? Who's in there? Is it the male or the female right now waiting for the other one to come back? Can you tell?
It's mostly the males that are in the burrows at the moment. So the males usually return first, and they're kind of, we say, spring cleaning the burrows. So they usually return to the same burrows every year. So they're getting the burrows ready and digging them out deeper and then tidying them up and then waiting for their mate to return.
So could we actually be witnessing a really special moment here where the females are actually coming back for the first time then?
Yeah, so for some of the birds, because it's so early in the season, there'll be a few that have already returned and found their mate, but there are many that are just in their burrows waiting and not knowing when or even if their mate is going to return. So for some of them, tonight could be the very first night that they've come back and they're reunited.
Wow, that's amazing. And they'd just be able to tell from their call.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. To us, they all sound very similar, and there's no way we could differentiate between individual birds from their call, but they seem to be able to do it, and they won't have been with their mate for the whole of the winter season, so this is the first time that they've been mating up since around September, so they still managed to remember and find each other, which is quite amazing.
Leslie Watt and the Manx Shearwaters on the island of Rum. More from Rum in just a moment. We chat to that couple who have just relocated there. I've been up, know, in the night time, just waiting to hear these birds coming back in again. It was later in the season I was there when the chicks were actually in the burrows and the adults were out feeding during the day and coming back and feeding them at night. That's an extraordinary experience. We were talking earlier about this barking noise that we could hear, and we know what it is now.
It's a fox. We've seen the fox, but this fox seems to be very agitated.
Yeah. For some reason, it's running around the trees at the bottom of the drive here in BBC Aberdeen, and it comes out and it kind of looks at us, but you hear the sort of bark, 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 you know, noise that it's making. It's as if it's trying to attract other ones or something. I don't know.
I don't know. There's something that it's not happy about anyway. It's been kind of going round and round in circles.
Yeah.
There it goes.
You can hear it there just now. Yeah. You know, and it started off way down there somewhere, you know, off to my left, essentially, and worked its way up, and then we saw it at the foot of the drive.
If anyone's got any ideas what's upsetting the fox, text us on 80295.
Yeah, quite. You're listening to Outdoors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. She's Helen not. No, she's Helen Needham. What am I saying? Helen Needham. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
You can catch up whenever you like by looking at the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or you can download the free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. We do like hearing where you listen. You can email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is exactly what Greg Davis in Lexington, Kentucky did. He says, "Dear Outdoors, during the pandemic I've been commuting to and from the hospital on foot the mile and a half each way. One of the morale boosters along the way has been vicariously revisiting Scotland via your programme. During your recent podcast featuring Jenny Sturgeon, I was walking home when a convergence of her singing, a red-tailed hawk landing in a nearby tree, and the waxing crescent moon brought tears to my eyes in the best of ways.
As we celebrate Thanksgiving over here, I want to thank you for being there and for all the music, personalities and books I've discovered through the show." And that's from Greg in Kentucky. Well, thanks very much, Greg. We really appreciate comments like that. It's great to hear that people are actually really enjoying our podcasts. And thanks to everyone else who sent in comments about the Jenny Sturgeon, Nan Shepherd podcast.
Coming up, we've got new arrivals on the island of Rum, and of course we reveal the identity of this week's mystery bird. Here it is to tease you again.
We have some correct answers, including Bill Higgins, but he also says, "Another really good programme hearing Dr. Mark Young's interview. Mark's enthusiasm for micro moths has passed on to me and many others in the moth recording world."
Excellent, good stuff.
Good to hear. Quite a few...
You're burning the script.
Well, no, that's... Oh, dear, that was foolish.
It's foolish. Blown off the fire.
Oh dear.
And is now underneath the OB van. Let's not worry about details.
Now, this is an interesting one. Lorna from dull Aberfeldy, twinned with boring Oregon, apparently.
Yeah.
Sandpiper.
It's Ontario, I think. Is it boring in Oregon or Ontario?
I don't know.
I thought it was. Yeah, but I've seen the sign. I think it's Ontario.
Well, she lives there. She probably knows.
Well, yeah, let's just say somebody's covered it down, right?
Okay. Anne in air. So she says sandpiper. No. Anne in air. Is it a blue tit? No.
Nope.
Alistair in Edinburgh, grey wagtail, crisp morning down in Perth, and he says, "Your mystery bark is a fox."
Yeah, it's true. That's correct. Absolutely true.
Correct.
You're right there. Yeah.
And Greg from the Heed, morning from Gateshead, just getting ready to go on a chilly bike ride along the Tyne. Is it a grey wagtail? Even if it's not, I hope to see one later.
See, I used to cycle a lot, you know, at night, you know, doing late shifts and early shifts and things like that, etc. This time of year, it's cold. It is cold.
Yeah, but it's always worth it because you feel good afterwards.
Well,
you
say that, don't you?
You do. It's like me going swimming in the North Sea. It makes you feel good afterwards.
Just tell folk about what you were doing the other day in Stonehaven Harbour.
Well, yesterday I started doing this completely by chance, going into the sea once a week with some female
in your swimming cosy, not in a neoprene wetsuit.
Yeah, that I was inspired by Philip Hoare, who we had on a few months ago, who goes swimming in the sea every day of his life. Mm-hmm. He doesn't wear any clothes at all. I'm not taking it that far, but yep, it's good for you.
And a huge disappointment to the folk of Stonehaven. Well, half of them anyway.
We do it in a little secret place, but it is very bracing.
Yeah, just how do you feel when you come out of the water?
I just feel great. I feel alive.
Yeah.
It's really good. Anyway, more of this. Shirley in air says a bullfinch. No.
Nope.
And this is my favourite one so far. Gaffey in Westray, Orkney. Your mystery bird this week is definitely a common snot warbler.
You're just not taking this seriously. Honestly. Yeah.
Well, if anyone has got a serious or any amusing, actually, we do like a bit of humour.
Don't
cheer us up on a Saturday morning. Outofdoors at bbc.co.uk, text 80295.
You want to try burning the building down again? No. Okay, fine. Couple from Bristol have decided to up sticks and move to the Isle of Rum after winning a competition to live in the island. Alex Mumford and Elizabeth Cracknell have never visited the island before, but were inspired after watching a TV show about life on a croft in Rum. Liz is commonly known as Buffy, so Alex and Buffy join us now from their spanking new eco home. Good morning to you both. How are you doing?
Hi, good morning. We're very well, thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, good morning. Listen, why? Why? What on earth possessed you to begin a new life on a Scottish island in the depths of winter?
Well, we, as you said, we saw the island on television and then stumbled across the applications for the new homes during lockdown. During lockdown, we realised that we weren't really city people, so we were trying to find other options and different ways of living. We applied for this and lo and behold, we're sitting on a settee on a new house at the moment.
And so how's your first day been? What's it been like? What are your first impressions of being there?
Oh, well, it's amazing, but on our first day, as expected, it just poured and poured with rain. But the scenery is just so stunning, even with it pouring like that. And then we've been getting everything ready in the house and just sorting everything out. And the neighbours have been really friendly. And it's been lovely. It's been better than we expected.
I mean, obviously, you're not... Sorry, beg your pardon, Helen.
I was just going to say, because you've not actually been there before, have you?
No, we've seen it on TV, we've seen it in pictures,
we did attempt to come up to visit, but then the second lockdown was announced, so we had to turn around and come back.
Oh, no. I mean, you're not there on holiday. I mean, you're going to be there to live. What do you both do that's going to work on an island?
So we've got a few self-employed business options that we're looking at throughout the year. I also work with children, so I've got a lot of childcare management skills and qualifications.
Yeah, I do remote work. I can do remote working with marketing or content management. So, yeah, so I've got easy options there on the internet. Great. So.
And what is your house like? Your eco house?
Yeah, so we've got a lounge kitchen with a wood burner, views over to the mountains and up the hills. It's two bedroom, bath and shower at the other end, solar panels for hot water, oil tanks in the back garden.
Basically, we've got all the mod cons, it's really nice and it's very modern. So it's really good. We're just figuring out all the different switches and that sort of thing at the minute.
Well, joining us now is Steve Robertson, who's Development Officer at the Rum Community Trust, who helped design the process. Steve, you had to whittle down 4,000 inquiries to four successful families. What was the criteria you were using?
Good morning. I
It was actually the board who actually sifted things down. But the criteria we were using were, I guess, common with a lot of rural areas, and we borrowed the basic framework from West Harris Trust, who used a similar kind of system of looking at economic regeneration targets and families. And those are two of the key areas that we looked at. And people who could support themselves, as Alex and Buffy have shown how they plan to do that, remote working or playing a key role like looking after kids, or if you have kids yourself, those were part of it. They weren't all essential, but they helped people, helped us sift out those numbers from 4,000 inquiries, 440 actual applications down to the ones who actually succeeded in getting the homes.
Rome's got a fascinating history. I mean, you had the Buller brothers building Kinloch Castle there, you know, and you know, which is fabulous and fantastic, but not without its problems. Then Scottish Natural Heritage kind of inherited the island. Then there was the community buyout, which was basically the people who were buying it out were the people mostly working for Scottish Natural Heritage in the first place. Although, you know, there was nothing improper in that; it was just the way it actually worked. You know, but essentially, what you're trying to do is now build a new community from scratch. It's an interesting piece of social engineering.
It's a big challenge, and I guess what we have to do in my job as a development officer is looking for opportunities to actually make those things happen, and not being too focused on we want X to happen, but there's no funding for it or whatever. So the funding for this these houses appeared from the Rural and Islands Housing Fund through the Scottish Government, and so we went for that, and they worked with us to make this this aspect of the project of our vision is a success, getting new people to the island. So with Alex and Buffy on the island, they're one of the first couples we've managed to get to the island into a new home for since we started as a trust back in 2007.
So Steve, you live on Rum, obviously.
No,
you don't live on Rum, right? Okay, so
no.
What do you think is success? You know, what is the key to being able to live on an island? If you've come from a different environment, you know, not if you're from an island, but what do you think? What's your advice to Alex and Buffy?
Every single person who does live in Rum just now is not originally from Rum. So everyone who's on Rum, as Mark was saying, a lot of the older people on the island now still had a legacy in SNH. That's why they came to the island. They had a job there, they got a job there. And they've stayed and made a success of their lives there. And I'm based on the mainland. They recruited me off island 6 years ago, and I'm still full-time working for the island. And I've had to get to know everybody who lives on the island now. And yes, there's lots of different reasons why people stay in the island and want to live on the island. Some of the best bits, I think, a lot of folk would say, is just the fact that it's a beautiful place to live, as Alex and Buffy were pointing out. There's lots of benefits to living there, whether it's raining or not. The wildlife, the just the beauty of being there, but also the excitement of having to manage any incident that comes along. There's no B&Q to go to buy that little vital bit of stuff to make the job you're doing so much easier to do. There's no contractors on the island, no joiner, no plumber, no electrician. So all of those challenges are, if you're the kind of person who enjoys that, and hopefully Alex and Buffy will enjoy some of those challenges, you have to be able to turn your hand to whatever comes along, and with whatever you have in the ways of food, friends and gear. That's part of the excitement, and I think that's what people like about being there.
Alex and Buffy, I mean, you're basically still at the stage where you're probably still exploring the house and trying to see what's in the cupboards, that kind of stuff. What's your plans? I mean, how are you going to approach this over the next few weeks? How are you going to sort of immerse yourself in island life?
So I think we're going to carry on obviously through our house and make sure everything's in order, learning how it all works. We're going to do a lot of exploring of the island over the next few weeks, and hopefully get to know the community and just how the community runs and and kind of have a look around and see what is required in certain areas and try and plan forward.
Yeah, one of the things we really wanted to do when we spoke about the island was be part of the community, and I think finding out what's required and how we can help is definitely a big part of living here.
Yeah. No, well, we wish you all the very best with it. I mean, it's a great adventure, and I hope you're thoroughly enjoying it. Alex, Buffy and Steve, thank you all for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No bother. Take care. Do you fancy it?
I don't know. I quite enjoy going to Ireland. I haven't really thought about it for a long time.
No.
I'm not. I've said in the past, I'm not sure I could live in an island because there's almost a total lack of privacy. You know, it's a goldfish bowl, and as somebody pointed out to me years ago, you know, you don't go to an island to get away from your troubles. You know, if you go to an island with troubles, they get magnified on an island, but just because of the way you have to live to a certain extent. Of course, if you disagree with that, you can contact us.
I know, I was just thinking, you're wishing Alex and Buffy well on their journey, aren't
you,
Mark?
I do. But they may not have any problems. Who knows? I think it is a great adventure. You know, and just because it's not right for me doesn't mean it's not right for them.
You have to be super organised with your shopping.
Yeah, super, super organised. Yeah.
And I suppose more people might be attracted.
So you walk back through the door.
Oh no, darn, I forgot.
Milk, yeah. And you went out for something 3 days ago.
Frozen milk, I think that's what they do, don't they? Yeah. They've got all sorts of tricks. Actually, if an islander is listening, any tricks, any tips for
any
Alex
tips?
And Buffy,
yeah.
You can text us on 80295, email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
The importance of warm woolly socks.
Always.
Always. Always. Earlier I was talking to Daryl and Catriona at Hackley Bay, which is just south of Colliston, and they were doing path repair work there on Forvey Nature Reserve. And it was a beautiful day, and it's one of my favourite parts of the world. And I must confess, I decided, right, I'll go and I'll interview them, and I'll wander back up, and I'll go to another bay, and I'll just spend some time by myself, which I did. So I climbed down the hill onto this rocky beach. It's a stony rocky beach. Blue skies, waves breaking on the shore, sun shining, built a fire, and I recorded some of the sounds. And when I brought it back home, I thought, what to do with this?
Mountain stone, mountain bone. Shattered by ice, splintered by time, rolled out and rounded by water and moon, lies here on this clattering beach. Dreaming slow stone dreams of the day it will once again rise into the sky. Fire is a time machine. Strike the match, touch the wood, and the heat and light of a summer many years gone flickers in the here and now. The wave can still taste the wind, can remember her touch, her insistent pulling and tugging, her sudden rush and silence. He remembers the velvet dark and a million stars, and, grieving for his lost love, falls weeping on the shore. Just like a flower, a child stands and stares up into a bright blue sky, darker than the blue of a gannet's eye, made bluer still by the white tracery of gulls and terns. Face to the sun, the child's own sky blue eyes look up and up and never stop.
Very nice work, Stephen. I am looking forward to your volume of poetry being published.
Well, that's five now, so might take a wee whiley. Late starter.
Lovely, and I like the way that you executed that.
All right, execute. Yes. Bang!
You put your posh poetry voice on there.
Put my posh poetry voice on there. Yeah.
No, very nice, though.
No, look, oh, look at that. Look. The gulls have just come out from behind the church there, you know, and there's basically a flock of them flying, and it was there's just a hint of light in the eastern sky, and it just caught the colour. There was almost, they were almost the underside of them. There's that sort of pinkish colour. That's lovely.
Well, there you go. There's another subject for you.
Number six.
Yeah. Now, we've got tons of correct answers for the kingfish. Oh, I just said it. Well, that is the correct answer.
The correct answer is big mouth.
Kingfisher.
Right. Susan and Jeff Dunn from under the duvet in Eaglesham says, it's a kingfisher. Yes, Helen, it is. Susie Spott says kingfisher. Keith Sutherland, Blair Gowrie, Ross and Tainall, Ali Williams, Katrina Dingwall, Colin and Mary Abercrombie in Dunblane, Alex Gilfillan in Crossgates, Rose Scott in the Black Isle, and Russ. All got the correct answer.
Alan in Selkirk, George in Inverurie. Mary says, the sound of the water is the clue. I think it's the kingfisher. What Dara McNulty, the young Northern Irish nature writer in his book Diary of a Young Naturalist, calls a blue light darting across the river. I would love to know why this amazing colour has evolved. There has to be a reason. Does anyone know? Well, maybe it will be revealed shortly.
That's actually a very good question. Why are kingfishers blue? I don't know. The last time I saw one was, what do you call that area in... It begins with a D.
Give
in
us a
Edinburgh.
Clue.
It's in Edinburgh. I mean, basically, you go underneath the bridges. Underneath the bridges. Basically, you come off the end of Prince Street and go down the hill. I don't think it is Duddingston.
Right.
But there was, I was out there running one morning, and it, again, this kind of light, probably slightly darker, if anything. Uh-huh. And a kingfisher went right up the centre of the river at enormous speed, as they do. And it was, it was like the opening sequence in Mission Impossible, where they light the fuse.
Yeah.
It was just like this blue fuse burning straight up the river. Beautiful thing to see.
They are remarkable. Dougie from Glenroth has got it right. He says he sees them regularly when fishing on the Eden in Fife. A great show, as always. Right. Doug in Olness, Paddy in Aberdeen, and Liz. Remember Liz, who was baking marmalade cake. She actually said that she hears them when she's kayaking. That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
No, that would be lovely.
So let's hear all about them.
The kingfisher is arguably our most colourful bird. It favours slow-moving, quiet streams, rivers and canals, searching for small fish and larger aquatic insects. And they're surprisingly seen quite often in Scotland, with an increasing population, mainly in the central belt and east coast. Usually, it's a flash of orange and electric cobalt blue at great speed, which barely registers. The usual reaction, a double take. What was that? As the kingfisher catches fire in the low light of dawn or sunset. But be patient, and the bird will return for the downriver journey as it patrols its territory on the hunt for food. Known in Ireland as the water spear, which refers to the bird's dagger-sharp bill, it nests in excavated tunnels and vertical riverbanks, and in a good season, the kingfisher might have several broods of chicks. Aristotle noted the legend that, according to the ancient Greeks, kingfishers built their nests on a raft of fish bones. And having laid their eggs, they set the nest afloat on the Mediterranean Sea and incubated them for the 7 days before and after the winter solstice. In order to ensure a successful brood, it was said the gods always made sure that the seas and the winds were calmed during this period. The Greek name for kingfisher is Halcyon, leading to the term Halcyon days, which was originally a reference to that strange period of calm and fine weather which happened in Greece in January, and now the joyous days of summer. In Celtic folklore, it's said that dead kingfishers preserved in a dry place will never decay, and if put among clothes and other articles, they'll preserve them from moths and give them a pleasant odour. Another old folk tradition describes how a dead kingfisher hung by a thread from a post will always have its beak pointing in the direction of the prevailing wind. Which, when you think about it, is a folk tradition of the blinking obvious. A kingfisher, said to be the first bird to fly from Noah's Ark after the deluge, supposedly received the orange of the setting sun on its breast and the blue of the sky on its back. Considered a symbol of peace, promising prosperity and love. The kingfisher waits on a branch over the river or pond, and then when it spots a stickleback, launches itself into the water, grabbing the fish in its powerful beak before returning to a favourite stone or post where the fish is dispatched with a firm whack. Kingfishers were viewed as remorseless destroyers of fish. A nesting pair can catch over 100 fish in one day, but they're taking minnows and sticklebacks. Unfortunately, the owners of trout fisheries thought otherwise, and they were almost exterminated in the 19th century. Even before that, kingfishers, through the 1566 Act for the Preservation of Game, operated on the delusion that the dipper and the kingfisher were the same species, and both were taking salmon and trout and had to go. Bounties were paid for both birds. And even in 1879, the Duchess of Sutherland authorised the slaughter of 368 dippers, a species that mainly eats the larvae of caddisfly. But finally, as someone who saw the river catch fire recently, streaking through the intense light of an early Perthshire morning, the best myth of all, that only the righteous get to see a kingfisher.
You and there were some fascinating facts about the kingfisher, and obviously that last one can't be right.
Yeah, he just made that up, didn't he?
Yeah, only the righteous can see a kingfisher. Well, he's got nature. Absolute nature.
Well, and thanks to everyone who got in touch with us with the correct answer.
Yeah, and indeed thanks to everyone who got in contact with us with the wrong answer.
Yes,
because sometimes they're even more amusing.
Exactly, we do enjoy it, and we hope you take it in good spirit.
Yes, absolutely. Like, you contact this programme, you get what you deserve. That's just what happens. Let's close this programme with a final tribute to Hamish McInnes, because joining us now is a long-term friend of this programme and also a friend of Hamish McInnes, David Heavy Whalley, former RAF Kinloss Mountain Rescue Team Leader. Morning, Heavy. How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. You became lifelong friends with Hamish. When did you first meet him?
Well, actually, I met him in the early 60s. When my dad and my mum and me were coming off Bideon in the mist and we got a bit lost, and this long gangly guy came up and helped us down, and he took us to his wee house for a cup of tea, because my father was a minister and few people know that story. So Hamish never let on when I joined the team that he'd kind of rescued us, and as a young boy just watching and seeing what was going on with him, you know, I kind of formed a bond over the years, which was amazing.
And what was he like as a person?
As a person, he was fantastic. And, you know, people have met, you know, have said so much about him. But the great thing to me, he was a normal person, even though he was a world-famous mountaineer by then. Yeah, his mountain rescue team, as most of them were in these days, was formed of keepers and shepherds. And he had his own climbers in the Glen called the Glencoe Mafia, who gave the technical expertise that was needed along with Hamish. So to me, he was, you know, a people person, and he was witty. His sense of humour was dry. He always had an answer, yet he was quiet. He sounded a bit aloof, but once you got the measure of him, he was a fantastic person.
He was hugely instrumental in the establishment of proper mountain rescue procedures. I mean, you know, it's something you've been heavily involved with across the years too. Just explain how influential.
Well, when mountain rescue was kind of forming, the main kind of teams were, there was a few teams about, but the RAF was quite heavily involved. And, you know, Hamish worked very hard to get the mountain rescue committee going, get the police on board and try and get little bits of kit and not make it, and I know this sounds daft, but not a police takeover. He was very, very good at moving things and getting things working. And once he, you know, got it working along with the other key figures, he kind of pulled out and ran his team. So he was a very, very good politician. Hamish knew everybody, you know, from, you know, top of the tree to everywhere, and he was very, very good and very respected with it.
We've had an email in here from Don Shanks, Heavy, who you know. He says, yeah. Good morning, along with my fellow RAF team leader Heavy, I worked alongside Hamish on quite a few mountain rescues and was always impressed with his quiet demeanour and professionalism. Mountain Rescue has lost an icon who had done so much to develop rescue equipment to make volunteers work safer. He was very well respected by all the rescue helicopter crews, who were always glad to hear he was on scene when approaching a rescue scene. A great man and a great loss.
Yeah, I know Don very well. I took over Lucas' team from Don down in Fife, so we were Hamish always used us an awful lot. But his bond with the helicopters was incredible, because Hamish developed some unique things they did, and when you look back, it was amazing what they did in these early days. And he was also filming anyway, so he knew what a helicopter could do, and you know, he pushed the standards in the helicopters. And you know, he made so many friends in the helicopter world as well. So, and not just in the RAF Mountain Rescue and all over the place, always willing to give advice. And even though he was this world class mountaineer, you know, and if you treat it in a football level, he was top of his game. Yet he still had time to help the little mountain rescue teams, Ascent, and you know, the smaller teams, and down in the borders, and give them stretchers and help them out. He, you know, he really was a champion of the teams.
We've all, I suppose, got little black books, you know, with contacts in it, etc. But Hamish's had got some really big names and ludicrously big names.
Yes, and I mean, because I was very lucky, I was taken to Hamish's house, and I would always take the young guys over on the hill and come back, and Hamish would drop a name that Chris has been on the phone, and some of these guys didn't know who it was, or the girls, and you'd say it'd be Chris Bonington, or it could be Sean Connery, and he was just dropping these names all the time, not as an ego thing. This is the people he spoke to, and politicians. If you wanted something done anywhere, Hamish could do it. He knew somebody, and people knew him, which was phenomenal. And he pulled us out a lot of scrapes over the years. Such was his little black book would be a wonderful thing to see.
But of course, he did experience a period of ill health that was really challenging for him, and was documented on that film, which has been on iPlayer recently, The Final Ascent.
Yes, and I was very honoured to be part of his little kind of group of people he phoned, and it was heartbreaking. I never thought he'd break through that, to what happened to him, you know. And, you know, how he got his memory back and fought back. He read all his books, you know, to get his memory back. I mean, and he just said it was like, he said it was like a really awful expedition. You know, and it just went on and on. But his memory was just amazing, just incredible. And it all came back to him.
I was watching an exchange on Twitter the other day between you and Davy Gunn from Glencoe. You know, and basically you were saying that, you know, you were Hamish's boys.
Yeah.
Explain that. What does that mean?
Well, Davy Gunn was one of the... This is a great thing with Hamish. Davy Gunn was one of the young boys in the Glen at the time, and Hamish took him under his wing, got him his first boots, let him join the team, and that was Hamish. You know, he did a lot. Davy was one of Hamish's boys, along with a lot of them. And some of these guys in the Glen at the time, the big climbers that came to live, you know, became part of his mafia, you know, quite Cubby, Dave Cuthers, and they filmed all over the world with Hamish. You know, Hamish, he's such a network of people, it was just amazing. And if you were a friend of Hamish, it's very, very hard to explain, but you were very, very lucky to, you know, to be part of that little thing. I was never that part, but I was very lucky. Me and Hamish seemed to go on. I could go away with murder with him at times, because he liked my sense of humour. So that was great, and it was a great honour to know him, and I saw him a lot, especially towards the end. Until then, and he phoned me every week, and you couldn't get him off the phone. It was just amazing the way he could remember incidents and call-outs, and fantastic.
It'll be a sad loss, Heavy, and thank you very much for joining us this morning and talking about your friend. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much indeed. Goodbye.
No, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dave, Heavy, Wally there.
I just want to read out this message that's come in. This is from Margaret. She says, I used to go for a duke at Sandend or Banff after a day's tatty roguing at nearby farms. Bracing, but very invigorating. Woolly socks and jerseys, a must for journey home, after which we enjoyed barbecued goodies from the butcher in Portsoy. And she says, sorry, text too late to get in my Kingfisher answer. So she was correct.
Yes, yeah, see, not goodies from the butchers, but we were in the cafe in White Hills last weekend and we had smoked haddock mornay.
What's mornay?
Just cheese sauce.
Oh.
Cheese sauce and mash. But I tell you, they know how to do fish in White Hills.
Right.
They really do. Just beautiful. I mean, the fishing community, fussy.
Know what they're doing.
Fishy, fishy, fussy, fussy. That's what it is. Exactly. Sadly, that's all we've got time for this week. Please don't forget to download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is published at noon today. And we've got a really interesting midweek podcast, which is going to be published on Wednesday. Two historians have been looking at the connection between Highland estates, people buying Highland estates off the back of proceeds of slavery. Absolutely fascinating stuff. Until then, from all the team here in Aberdeen, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.